Blog Talk Radio.
Morelia Python Radio, brought to you by Morelia Python Forums, the best carpet Morelia forum on the web. That's www.moreliapythonforum.com. What's going on, Owen?
What's going on is I'm trying to fix this thing in my freaking cage. there's a loose probe in the cage in my head. If you hear me scream, it's because an Aaron Jay has just bitten me in the face.
You know that Aaron Jay's plate.
Precious has been averted.
Jungle.
I deal with this all Saturday. Don't you deal with this anymore? Get these polished turds off my table.
We have a pretty exciting show tonight. We have Ari Flagel on, and he's going to be talking about his adventures over in New Guinea that he just recently came back from a trip over there, and it's going to be quite exciting to hear about the adventures of probably everybody out there's dream field herping adventure. I mean, can you imagine?
I love having Ari on, because then we can vicariously live through him. And
yeah.
Like he's like, oh man, we were trudging up this mountain in New Guinea. I'm like, God damn it.
Damn you.
He's like, and then there was like 25 bull-ins right at my foot, and I'm like, Jesus Christ!
Yeah,
it's amazing to hear about these things, and you know, it's like one day I'll just be like, you know, and then it was Owen was there too, and I'm like, yay! But
I mean, you want to talk about a wonderland of Morelia? I mean, that's pretty much the place to be. So,
sort of Australia itself, that is,
I think,
like second. And not by much. So.
So we'll get him on, and his buddy that went with him is Tom. I think his last name is Mendelson. He took a trip over there, so he's going to be calling in too. And you know, both those guys are sick and beat up, and they're still coming on to talk. All about the trip. So we thank them for that. So
when we invite you to come on Morelia Python Radio, I mean, can't say no.
Well, look at both of us, Owen. We went out. We've been sick twice. So, I mean, these guys are true troopers. I mean, we're the host of the show when we went out.
And they're better. Exactly. We went out and called Luke, and they're just like, no, must be on the show.
Yeah.
Even better if, like, they were like, oh, we pushed to get on the show. Where's Owen? Oh, he's out. Luke's going to be filling in for him. Like, oh, son of a bitch.
Yeah.
So.
You have to get an email about that, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But we're coming off of a pretty cool Hamburg show, I thought. Not a lot of traffic going on, but it was cool to hang out with you and Chris and Zach. And
it's a typical December show. It's kind of dull-ish. They definitely pick up as the weather goes. And actually, which was strange, for a Hamburg show, as I told you right when you got in, four vendors didn't show up, which is extremely rare for a Hamburg show. Normally, that place is packed to nines and you can't get a table. For them not to have vendors show is kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, a couple of cool things that I thought that was pretty exciting. I don't know if you remember the gentleman's name that came up, and he bought his first carpet, and we tried to sell him on the IJ, but he wasn't going for it, and then we tried to sell him on a Jag, and he wasn't going for that, so he ended up with the Normal Coastal.
Yeah. It's a great place to start.
Yep. That's where I started. That's where you started, yeah. So
exactly where I started. Normal Coastal, best place to start.
Yeah, it was cool to see that you know that there's an interest out there and that you know people are getting to it. Yep. Had a couple people that came up and they asked, you know, do you have any jungles or do you have any yellow, really yellow ones? I said, well, you want
to
go two aisles down.
Two aisles down and tell her Owen and Eric sent you. We didn't actually get to ask her how many people came up to her and said, Eric and Owen sent me.
Howard
was bopping around. Jason stopped by our table a few times.
Yeah.
Some other really cool things that were there is... few tables down had baby rough scales.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. I think we were trying to distract them and take IJs and stick them in their place or something.
That was my plan because you had IJs that kind of looked like the colors. I'm like, listen, let me take those crap things from you and let me swap them out for the roughies. And you're like, do I get the roughies? I said, no, my roughies.
He won't.
Your animals.
No. A couple of things that I noticed there is I wanted to give a shout out to Matt Minatola. He was on the show a couple weeks back, and I actually got to stop over at his table. And if you don't know who Matt is, he's local to the Philly area, where we're from, and he runs Philly Herpticulture, and that's www.phillyherp.com. But his Borneos are sick, man. I mean,
huge things, man. They were massive.
He had these striped ones and the ocelot.
Yeah.
Oh man, they were awesome. So if you're in the market for some Borneos, that's I'm telling you, man, he's the place to go to. So
are you going to be in the market for some Borneos soon?
You know, I think there's so much.
You didn't answer that fast enough.
Well, you know, if I had unlimited space, you know, and unlimited funds.
I definitely would, but
there's a couple things that I want on my list before I get that. One being Boland's Python, so it's kind of why I'm excited.
We have Ari on.
Yeah, talking to him soon. I wanted to give a shout out to Zach Baez. He took the trip up with me, and he got me out of being lost a couple times. I don't know what the hell's up with my GPS. I got to switch it, but. I followed you, and the next thing I know, you're gone, and I don't know what happened.
Well,
but
it was funny because we turned, and I'm like, you know, Eric was following us, and Chris is like, really? All right, and doesn't slow down at all. And I'm like, all right, I guess Eric knows the way. And then Chris and I actually missed the exit, blew right past it because he and I were talking about something, and had to go through the Lehigh Valley Tunnel and double back, basically add another 45 minutes onto the trip. We get there. You don't show up for another... probably another hour. I'm like, where the hell is he?
Yeah.
I was expecting you to be there going like, what the hell? Where'd you guys go? We can't get in.
Me and Zach stopped for breakfast.
Right. That was, I think that's
a
lie you were supposed to tell me, but it didn't work.
But, it was cool to talk to him and I didn't know he was on Urban Jungles Radio a couple times. He was telling me he did, he did some things with conservation and his art. He's an artist, and that was pretty cool. So I got to listen back to those episodes and hear him. So that was pretty
cool.
Very cool. The only other thing that I wanted to give a shout out to is looking at pictures over on Morelia Pick of the Week, and this group of pictures really, really caught my eye was the ones that Evan Arambol did. I think that's his last name. And he goes by Thunderwood over on Moralia Forums. But the photos he did with the desert and the backdrops, you got the male brettle.
What the hell?
It was on the rocks. And then the one that was called Mountain Chondro. I mean, badass pictures, man. Really, really
like
cool.
Straight from the freaking wild.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just had to give a shout out for them because you got to give credit where credit's due. He has some really cool pictures going on over there at Morelia Pick of the Week, or you can see him over on the forums. But definitely cool. What else is going on with you, Owen?
What else is going on with me is we're in the midst of trying to put pairs together, figure some stuff out. We're cooling down our gold phase white lips. We decided to give them a shot this year. And cooling down the Barnex. We're getting ready to go. And, which I blame you and Mr. Buscemi for horribly, is that Tannen Bars are on their way and will be here Tuesday. So now is when you can refer back to that episode where I said I'll never, ever own scrubs. So I'm pretty sure we're up to like 13, 14 scrubs now.
Yeah.
Between the Malukans, the Barnex, and now Tannen Bars. So
I think you're
Chris,
up to me, except for the Helma Harris. Yeah. Well, you have more actual scrubs than me, but as far as species go, you run
the
gauntlet.
I think that's the only one I'm missing,
yeah.
Don't mention that to Chris.
Dear.
I'm saying this to all scrub breeders that might listen. If Mr. Chris Foley of Rogue Reptiles contacts you, hang up on him. Love a god.
Fortunately for you, Owen, they're hard to come across. But
thank God. You're like, but I've checked you. Shut up.
Yeah. I didn't start cooling yet. I'm waiting a week because I knew that that was going to get warm today. It's like 60, 70 degrees today.
What the hell?
I'm trying not to confuse the snakes too much, so I want to wait until the temperature drops and it's good to go.
Well, I was kind of hoping that with the bounce and the temp that, like, I've been, like, not feeding. I've been kind of letting them cruise past each other. I've been kind of introducing soft and then putting them back in their own cage. And I was kind of hoping that with the bounce in the temps that I'd, like, come down and see, like, a surprise lock from – because there are a few pairs that are together that I'm keeping together because I'm frustrated and they have not bred. And that's the IJs because I'm nervous that I'm going to miss it. And that's the Red Tigers because, God damn it, this is, like, the fourth year I've tried to breed her, and she will breed, God damn it, I swear. I was kind of hoping I'd get a surprise lock.
I think the IJs need you to embrace the dark side, and then, and only then, will they lock inside your house.
Listen. In about a month or two, if you ask me, I will, okay? I would just be like, all right, fine. I will be a dark sider if they breed. Till then, I am the light sider with one dark mistake I keep hidden in the closet.
Well,
but, you know. What?
We can all have
weakness.
Those things,
yeah.
Right?
Thank you. I would say you have everything, so, yeah.
Okay. Well, I all guess right. Without any further ado, let's get this party going.
Right. Yeah.
Hey, welcome to the show. How's it going, Ari?
It's going. bear with me. I've got this flu thing going on. I'm hoping it's not the flu, but it's rough. But like I said, I wouldn't miss this this radio show for most anything. Yeah, most anything.
Yeah.
There are some things, but, you know, most of anything.
Yeah, most of
it. All right, so tell us about this. Tell us about the trip.
Wow, yeah. Okay, well, where do I start? I'm hoping Tom will chime in soon. He's probably frantically trying to remember the phone number to call in. And so he'll probably chime in right during the middle of what I'm saying. But we set out this time with intentions to photograph primarily the nesting season. And with that being said right there, I mean, that's kind of like, you're like, yeah, okay, whatever. You know, it's hard enough to find these things in the wild, but let alone we're going to find a nest, we're going to find eggs, you know, yada, yada. So we really planned this up well, and you know, with the countless amount of help from our partner Danny Gunalin, who's over in Jakarta, we were able to put this together. And I think the most incredible aspect about this whole trip, aside from what we found and were able to witness and take part in, was the fact that we did it in like record time, which is unheard of. It's everybody jokes about Indonesia with Indonesian time, basically giving that kind of impression that, you know, well, it's going to be, you know, lazy time or so and so, but we did it without any holdups and without any issues, and I cannot believe, I still can't believe we did it in that amount of time, which was phenomenal. So, Tom was my trip was roughly about a little over 2 weeks, I'd say, and Tom was out there for about, I think he was out there for, he was over a little over a month, but he was not in the in New Guinea that amount of time. He was doing other stuff too with, because we're also working on projects with Danny, and Tom's working at the farm over there, so he's been helping out with a lot of their side projects. So we kind of planned everything when he went out and heading back out there again, and kind of rendezvoused up and said, all right, let's do this, because you know, we need this data, and we're working on this other book, and it's going to be killer, man. I mean, and the stuff we found on this trip was just like, that's all I got. I mean, I don't think there's even words for it. It's just, that's it. You know, you gotta be kidding me. I showed a close friend of mine the photo, and he's like, oh, I'll pay $50 just for the photo, just to see it. So,
Jesus.
Yeah, so, but it was, I don't know, where do you guys want me to start? I mean, I got so many crazy, you know, things that we dealt with and just experienced. I mean, it's such a journey just to get there in the first part of it. I mean, you're in Indonesia, so everything's off as it is to an extent, and dealing with that, and then going out to Wamena, and then, you know, from there on, it's just, I mean, it's unreal. I mean, that's probably the best way to describe that. This is my third trip out there, and will not be my last. I'm being persuaded by several friends to take them with me, which will be fun. And whether we go into the Bolens habitat or not, it still will be entertaining, needless to say. But, I mean, where would you guys like me to begin?
I guess start at the beginning. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
start when you get over there, I guess.
Gotcha. Well, God, I'm hoping Tom chimes in. Come on, Tom, what's going on? Well, let's see, like I said, we geared this trip towards nesting season, and, you know, November, December, you know, November, early December is, you know, peak nesting season in the wild. And we basically put everything together where we're going to be able to hopefully, photograph and view a nest. And with that in mind, you know, it's such a difficult, wish in itself right there to be able to achieve that, let alone, like I said earlier, seeing them in the wild. So we got in and set everything up and then kind of started our way out there. It took us, to give you guys an idea, and I'm sure people that have heard me talk about before, you know, it takes about 3 days of travel from the States to get to Jakarta. And then from Jakarta, depending on where you're going, if you're going in the interior of New Guinea, like Wamena, which is, you know, basically, you know, some chondros and the Bolens hub, basically. Excuse me. It takes about another day of travel, I'd say, give or take. With that being said, I mean, like Indonesian time or, you know, America time, we could do it either way. But typically you lose a day or lose, you know, you have some downtime in between, so it gets difficult to get there. But we were able to do it. We flew out early that morning from Jakarta and got into Wamena the same day, which was like, I couldn't believe it, because normally we have a day or two where we're stuck in Jayapura trying to figure out, you know, how we're going to get over there. And we got in there and met up with our group that we were rendezvousing with. You know, it's kind of a shame because, you know, a lot of the Bolens that we're seeing now, you know, are still wild collected babies. But, you know, ultimately that's where we're going to be able to get the data that we need to really kind of put that behind us. So, and I mean, the animals aren't suffering by any means, in my opinion, in the wild. They're not having a problem reproducing and having, you know, producing eggs and all that. But that aside, you know, like I said, we're going to really need to focus on the people that see these things every day and interact with them, so we can take in that kind of information that they're able to witness and kind of utilize it and incorporate it to what we're doing. And so that's where we started. We started with the hunters, and these are the cream of the crop. These were the people that, you know, do this. This is what they do. And luckily enough, we were able to get them on board with what we were doing, and they wanted to get involved with, you know, the project and stuff like that as well. So we met up with our guides, and there were, like I said, these were the Chuck Norris of bullet collecting, I guess you could say. So we knew we were in good hands, and we get there, and I think we kind of grabbed a hotel real quick just to dump off all of our gear that we needed to do right away, or so that way we didn't have to lug everything and anything up there. I mean, with these huge packs of this and all our gear and stuff, and I think stripped it down to like a small backpack with just like just, you know, GPS, UV meters, temp guns, probes, weights, and all that jazz, and, you know, my photography equipment, and Tom as well, and then just carry that, because we didn't know really what we were going to be in store for. So we met up with one of our guides who wanted to get something to eat prior. So we were sitting there talking, and without even me kind of bringing it up, he pulled out a picture on his phone of like this image of like 12 little neonate babies that he had collected, and was just like, I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, what are we doing here? Let's just go, you know, let's do this. Come on, let's go.
Forget the food. It's already flipped the table.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just kind of smiling. So, from there it was like, oh gosh, I knew we were ready to rock and roll. And, then it was funny because after that we were taking a break, and I was like, oh man, I gotta go to the bathroom. So I walked outside, and Wilmina, I mean, aside from some of the photos I post and everything, it's people ask me, you know, like, what do you, you know, they expect it to be this amazing, tranquil, you know, place, and it's really just a dirty, sewage-filled kind of Mad Max scenario. And I refer to it as the skid mark in the already dirty pair of underwear, and that's what I basically perceive Wilmina as. But once you get outside of the town, everything is gorgeous, and it's just this pristine, you know, forest and jungle, and people are phenomenal. But so I sneak around the side of this building to go to the bathroom, and I kind of just, you know, thinking about what, you know, what's going to go on, and trying to pee, and I hear this like thump 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 thump, and I just kind of look over, and there's a cassowary that somebody had caught and stuck a cassowary in the back of their building. And if it wasn't for that chain link fence, I was like, I think I peed all of my boots and everything. And it was quite an event. So I,
wow.
Are you sorry to be killed by a cassowary?
Yeah, I photographed the bird.
He's only been in
the
for 5 minutes.
Yeah. And I'd never seen a cassowary there. And
right.
I was kind of like, Tom, check this out. There's a cassowary over here. You know, and the guy's like, oh, yeah, he caught it as a baby, and they stuck it behind the alleyway, and it's been living back here eating garbage. And I'm like, oh, great. You know,
that's
so
wonderful. Okay.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah. And so it was pretty entertaining. Caught me off guard. I had to do a double take. I'm like, that's a cassowary coming at me. I was like, wow, what do I do with this? You know, so, but, and, after that was said and done, we pretty much just took right off, and, we had a vehicle waiting for us to get us to the base of the camp where we were going to stay. And originally the drive out to where we were going was going to be around, I think, a 3 hour by vehicle drive to get to the base camp where we're going to stay. And And then from there, you know, it goes up, you know, go up in elevation to locate the snakes. So we, waited for our ride to come, came up, loaded up this little rickety old truck, and had a bunch of locals jump in the back of it for a free ride, and headed out of Wilmina up into this area. And so we get to the area, and I mean, we left in the evening because we wanted to, you know, we try to take advantage of this as quick as we could. We got in later, and so we get to this spot, and it's just, I mean, we're, you know, it's pretty rainy right now because we're kind of in like the rainy season, and the ground is just sopping wet and just mud, and it's such a different kind of mud. It's like this clay. It's just horrid. It's just, there's no pleasant thing about it, and there's no easy way to describe it. It's just disgusting and horrid. And we couldn't get past it in the vehicle, so we had to go on foot to an area. One of the guys that jumped in the back of the truck was like, "Oh, hey, I've got a place we can stay." So, and it's raining pretty heavy at that point. And when I say heavy, it's not like, you know, Central and South America where it's just downpour. It's just a constant rain, and it's just horrid. You know, it's just like, ugh, I'm ready to be done with this. And so we hike in about an hour in the dark and in the mud, slopping around, and everyone, we find this little hut, which they call a honai. And these people, you know, traditional, you know, people that live there just said, yeah, come on in, you can stay here. You know, so-and-so. And so we stayed there the night, and we left early in the morning. I think it was like 5 or 6, we were up. And since the road was so bad, it was going to take us to the site, we had to hoof it in. And a 3-hour vehicle drive to get there turned into almost 8 hours of hiking on foot. And it was just one of the most horrific things I've had to do. And it was wouldn't have been as bad because they had big, heavy machinery come through to kind of clear these cuts out through the sides of the mountains. And that's the roads we took to get up in there because it was a lot easier. But the roads were just mud, just like these slops. And you couldn't get any kind of footing of any sort. And when you did, your other foot would go out from underneath. So you were picking your feet up through this mud. And it was horrible. So you could get an extra 5 or 10 pounds on your boots just from the slop that you were walking through. So that – and then every time we walk over a hill, you know, several miles over the horizon, you see like this little village, and they're like, oh, it's right there. And then once we get to that little village, you know, they look over the mountain, they're like, oh, it's right there. So it just never ends. I looked at Tom and I was like, I think they're taking us out to kill us, you know. I think that's what it is.
Speaking of Tom, he's on the line.
Oh, sweet, you made it.
Yeah, yep. Hey Tom, you're live.
Hey guys, how are you
Welcome
doing
to the
good
show.
You made it on, Tom. Good thing. I was getting worried.
No, buddy. Here we are.
Okay, good. Yeah, I was telling him about walking through this disgusting slop that we had to do. And Jesus.
The mud is just incredible. The clay is just so thick and heavy, and it's slippery. And plus, we got, like, all our backpacks full of our gear. Just a horrible slog.
If you guys don't know, Tom and I have been good friends for a number of years. Tom and I are working on this Bones project together, as well as this new book. And Tom used to live in Indonesia for over 7 years, and so he speaks fluent and reads and writes it. So he's a very, very valuable asset to the group, as well as we have a very similar sense of humor, so we get along great, and we've just been buddies since. And you know, this is just one of the things that we get to collaborate with, which is just a blast. So it's we have a total, it's a killer time when we're out there. So, but go ahead, Tom. I just throw that out there for you.
Yeah, no, that's good. I've been through that kind of trekking before on Papua several times, and it's never fun. But it's rewarding at the end of the day because. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Well, how much worse would it have been for you guys if, like Ari was saying, if they hadn't moved all that heavy machinery through, giving you guys a little bit of a road?
I think it would have been easier because we would have been walking on, you know,
probably a little bit.
Yeah, it was just so rough. I mean, because it's just, I mean, it would have been a long walk and it would have been tiring, but the extra added factor of having to deal with all that slop, just, you know, dragging you down and slipping you and moving and trying to readjust where you're going to walk was just such a pain. That was the real horrid part of it. And then, you know, I'm straining to get up here, and Tom's pretty fit. He's up at the top there smoking a cigarette, looking at me, and I'm just like, you're an asshole. You know? we made it. So we got through all that, and finally, what did they keep telling us, Tom, when we go over the next hump or whatever?
Oh, the village is Tekat.
Tekat. They kept yelling. So they'd say it's close, and we'd get over and we'd look at a village and be like, Tekat. And then we'd go down in another 2 hours and be like, Tekat. And we're just like, oh, quit saying it. Just tell us it's far. Just tell us it's real far. So we probably, I think, went through, I'd say probably about 3 to 4 little villages that we passed through. And the areas are divided when you get there because they're all, you know, privately basically owned by these little families, so they have these kind of fences that you got to cross over and get permission to, because I mean, you're not just going to walk over these places, you're going to have problems. So it was helpful that we had, you know, the people we did with us, and our buddy was with us and was able to get us through these places. So, and then once they figured out what we were here for, they were like, oh yeah, come on in. So we walked through about three or four of these places, and we finally got to our site. And I think we sat down for maybe like an hour, Tom, or something. It was like, and then it was right back, you know, right. I think we were trying to kick as much time, you know, as possible, and just get up there.
Yeah, we got our muddy shoes and socks and nasty clothes and everything taken care of, and then we had a little rest, and it wasn't long before we were back on the trail. That's for sure.
We jumped right back up. I think we had some top ramen or cup of noodles, and then it was from there we jaunted up. And like I said, we did this in one day. We got, you know, from 6 a.m. to I think maybe 6 p.m. We went to the site, and which was incredible that we were actually able to do it in that amount of time. So we left the hut and went into the interior, and our guy introduced us to the person that was going to be taking us, and this individual basically maintains and monitors these nest sites. And and he said nests, and I kind of, you know, crapped myself when he said nests, because I was expecting maybe one. But he maintains, I think, how many was it, Tom, that he watches in this area?
In that one area alone, it was 14.
14 nests.
Wow.
Now, the downside of it is those nests are basically spoken for. The babies are collected up every year and distributed out, and they're sold, which, you know, money pays for, you know, family and, you know, to live.
Right.
So it's not like, you know, it's a wasted thing. But on the other aspect of it, it's the amount of information we learned just from him taking us and talking to us was invaluable. So we started this hike. It was just a really odd environment, as opposed to what Tom and I were in on our last trip, because this was very different from what I was used to. It was more of a boggy area, which I wouldn't expect to see anything. And we walked through these like marsh areas where it was just sopping wet, like pools that we'd step in, it would come up to your knees, and, you know, you pull yourself out, and it's just mud, and there's more water and moss everywhere. And then as we're climbing, I mean, it only took a while for me to realize that we were at the absolute top of the mountain, like we were on the top. Mm-hmm. And we didn't, you know, I didn't realize that we were up that high, because I was taking elevation notes too. And I think we got up to the said and done point. It was like 75, 76,000 feet. I think it's about right, Tom. I could be off a little bit, but we going through, and, you know, up and down and up and down and up and down. And, you know, it seemed like it was like hours and hours and hours. And I'm probably pretty sure it was probably maybe like a good 2 hour hike, but it just was, just intense, because we just came out of that 7.5 hour plus walk out of the, you know, mud pits. And we're coming through, you know, jungle, coming out of the jungle. And, you know, we're seeing all these different native plants that I'd never seen before, all this different kind of moss and this different lichen. I was finding wild pitcher plants, the Nepenthes plants that were up there.
Wow.
And, you know, they kept doing the takat junk on me again, and I'm just like, I'm tired. You know, come on, let's get to the place.
Shut
that we Yeah, and as we're going into these areas, you know, it's very primitive. It's very primitive still. I mean, and this whole area is. So they take, like, these big logs, and they toss these logs over these, like, channels and these rivers to cross.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're kind of shimmying over these wet, like, slippery logs, over these chasms almost, and to get to the other side. So we're doing this, and I'm, like, counting in my head. I'm like, okay, this is number two, number three, number four. Okay, we got four logs we cross over. Okay, blah, 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 you know, as I'm going.
These are all mountain streams coming down.
Yeah, and mountain streams coming through, and it's just, it's crazy, man. It's just like, it's absolutely nuts. And we get up to the top, and I'm, you know, and they're wanting, at this point, you know, I'm dragging because I'm just getting burned. I'm just getting so fatigued from the climb. And I could tell Tom was starting to slow down a little bit too. And we, you know, they're like, it's right here. And we're like, you know, where? So we come around this pass, and our guy starts digging in the ground. and the and I'm looking around and I'm like, from everything that, you know, I've researched and the people I've spoken to, I'm like, this is, does not look like, I'm like, I'm not standing on a rock face. I'm not standing between cliffs. I'm standing on a giant mound of fallen vegetation right next to a big dead log with 3 to 4 inch plus of water up my ankles, you know, and it's 62 degrees outside with a light rain. I'm like,
right.
Where the hell are we? You know, so he starts digging, and I pull out my camera and I start photographing, and he points in the hole, and sure as hell, there's a big snake sitting in there. And I'm like, and Tom and I at this point are just like, you know, you've got to be kidding me. And Tom is starting to shake because it was pretty cold out. And
yeah,
really cold out.
It was cold. I mean, it was like in the 60s, and it was a drizzle rain, and we're standing in water already, so it was getting cold. And you can see on the video, because we're filming it, you can see in the video, like, our breath coming and everything, too. So I was like, okay, it's pretty cold. But I wasn't that cold. I don't know why, but we were just standing, staring at this, and I'm like, there's a Bolan's python sitting in this hole. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I mean, first we're able to see the snake. So then I start photographing, and I start moving her. And then, like, I just kind of, my jaw drops, and she's sitting on a clutch of eggs.
Right.
Oh, wow.
And I'm, like, yelling to Tom, like, she's on eggs. And we start just
I'm videotaping the whole thing as
yeah, and he's filming the whole thing, you know, and shaking on the video. And I'm just like, I mean, if I was pissing my pants, you couldn't see because I was sopping wet already. But I was, I just couldn't, you know, we were sitting there and I'm like, we're here. We are photographing a snake. She is on eggs. And we're doing it. You know, it's like, there's no way. I was like, you know, I had to slap myself to wake up. I'm like, this is incredible. And so we kind of immediately go into like hyperdrive and start, you know, getting temperatures and, you know, measurements of everything and start recording everything we're seeing around, jotting numbers down and photographing and filming. And Tom's filming the whole thing as I'm doing this and we're kind of flip-flopping the cameras back and forth and just doing stuff. And so I'm like, you know, I'm going to take her out because I want to get measurements on the snake, you know, and do everything. So I start, you know, manipulating the snake. And I pull the snake out, and she is like the mother of all Bolan's pythons, I swear. I was not anticipating her to be that big. She had to be at least 10 foot plus. She was a huge snake.
Wow.
I mean, and is big around. I mean, Tom, what do you think she weighed? She was, I can't remember what we wrote down.
She was 17 to 20 pounds.
Yeah,
huge
snake. I mean, this snake was mammoth. Her head was probably about 3 inches across.
Wow.
She was gigantic. And the really strange thing about it, and we're filming and photographing this whole thing, we're just like, there's a point where I pull her out, and I'm expecting to get railed when I just stick my hand in there.
Yeah.
She was completely placid. No interest in me whatsoever. I was trying to do it really quick because I didn't want to disrupt anything, and I didn't want one of the locals to put a spear in my back for taking away their money for the year also. But we took her out, and I remember hearing Tom kind of gasp behind me like, whoa, like she's a big snake. And at that point, I was like, wow, this is a really big snake. And the weird thing, though, that really caught my attention, aside from how she was fit in the nest around the eggs, was how big she was. And she looked like she didn't lose a bit of weight at all. Like, she was stout. This was not a skinny
robust
snake at all. She was a big, well-fed snake. I mean, I just kept looking at her. I was like, there's no way this snake laid eggs. I mean, there was no way you could even tell there was a dent in her. And then we, you know, got all the weights, got all the measurements on her, photographed her, marked the nest site. You know, I think, trying to remember everything we did. Got a UV. I was doing a lot of UV stuff also. And I just kind of put her head back in there, and she went right in and went right around, coiled right around the eggs like we weren't even there.
Wow.
It was wild.
I'm sorry, but with the temp being so cold, what was she shivering at all, or was she?
No, she wasn't doing any twitching at all. We were watching her, and it could have been just that, you know, during that amount of time, she had generated enough heat. But I took outside temps from when we first started, you know, when they first started digging the nest out. Air temperature was 62 degrees. And as we started going in, it went up, and her outside coils were 75, and her eggs were 85 to 86.
Wow.
Okay.
And the chamber she was in, and when I say a chamber, it was like probably, I think we got measurements of like about a foot diameter all the way around. Like, she was packed in there, it was a complete circular kind of nesting area. There was no ins or outs. There was only one way in and one way out. And she was packed in there, and she was completely wrapped on those eggs as tight as she could possibly be. We got several photographs.
And it was a big cluster of eggs. There had to be at least 20 eggs in that
cluster.
Yeah,
it was huge. Wow. I counted at least 15 eggs that I saw.
Wow.
And, I mean, it was incredible. Like, and then it's like, you know, we're looking at them like, okay, you know, I'm here. What do we need to take? You know, what data do we need to take? What are we doing? And we start wrapping all this stuff up, and we're getting it going. And we're just sitting there kind of looking at each other like, you know, just dumbfounded. Like, what did we just see? What did we just take part in? And, excuse me.
Wow.
And at that point, we, you know, the locals started, like, filling in the hole, filling in the nest spot like we weren't even there, and we started walking around, and he wanted to take us to the other sites, but I was toast. I just couldn't do it. I had nothing. So I've never gotten to that point before where I had nothing left after walking almost a solid day through, you know, mud and, you know, God only knows what. So we started heading back down, and the sun started setting, and they were getting worried because it was going to get dark. So we started heading back once we got everything. And, you know, Tom and I are just kind of like in this daze of just like what we just saw. And I'm thinking to myself, did I get everything I needed? Did I photograph? You know, I was like, oh God. And I was like, okay, you have the camera. Okay, we got this. We're good. And it's like, you know, I'm wrapping up my camera. I'm taking my memory cards out. And I'm, you know, locking all my cards and putting them in like, you know, a box and a box and a box and a box, you know, so nothing can happen to this stuff. And we're walking out, and, you know, we're going down, and I am just like sloshed. I just can't do nothing. And we're coming out, and we're walking, and we get, you know, get over the first river and get over the second one, and I'm just struggling. And the local guide, we had two local guides with us. One of them was our friends, and the guy was taking care of the nest. They were getting kind of worried because it was getting dark. And we come up to this one spot where it's this log crossing, probably about a 10 to 15 foot, you know, drop going down into this mountain stream, big old boulders and all this junk.
And at least a 10 to 12 foot span over the river itself.
Yeah. And it's like this huge, it's just like this massive, and you just look at it, you're just like, oh God. And so I'm starting to walk over there, and the local's looking at me, and I'm like, you're going to have to hand me your hand because I'm not going to be able to walk across this thing. And I got my camera on my back, and I passed over my pack, and I put my hand out and I grab him and I walk and I'm walking and Tom at this point is ahead of me. And as I'm walking, I'm about dead middle in this thing, and all of a sudden I hear a snap. And all of a sudden it's just like boom, the log breaks, I go down and I'm dropping, and I'm just like, oh God. So I immediately grab my pack and I stick my camera over my head because I'm like, okay, screw it. I'm going down. I want to save the footage. You know, it's no way.
Tom, save the photos.
Save the footage.
Yeah.
And it's just like Tom hears the snap, turns back, I'm down, I drop 10 feet, and then the Papuan that was holding my hand comes in with me. So right as I come up out of the water, I get this face full of crotch of this Papuan guy, like right in my face, and I go jetting right back down in the water, and I'm still trying to hold, and they freaked out. They thought they thought we hit our heads on the rocks, and so we had to swim around this opening, and Tom had to help lift me out of there, and it was just like, by that time, I was like, I'm not going anywhere. So we're walking back, you know, I'm dragging myself back. And I was like, dude, I was like, I can't go any further. And it's dark at this point. So the guys went ahead of us. Mm-hmm. And we stopped at this river bank where there's a big tree. And Tom's like shaking like a leaf. He's freezing. Like, he's like freezing. And I've never seen him shake like this. And so I'm like, we got to build a fire. So we're trying to find bark off this tree that's not saturatedly wet, because everything is just sopping wet around us. We make this fire, and we don't have anything to light to get the fire going. But as far as kindling or anything, because luckily Tom's a smoker, and one of the other guys with us was a smoker, so we had a lighter, so we were good. But so I roll up our traveling permits, the Sarachalans. And which basically give us permission to travel through these interior areas in New Guinea. And the guide's freaking out because I'm burning our passports.
Oh,
like, and Tom is just shaking. And I'm like, I'm so sorry, man. I'm so sorry. We get this fire going, and we got a nice fire going, you know. We got that going on. I'm just sitting there, and we got a picture of me. Tom took a photo of me sitting there in front of this fire. And this, we were just like, we looked like we just crawled out of the sewer. And they came back.
Right.
And,
that was a lifesaver, though. Without
Oh, yeah. The Sinatra lawn saved our lives, so we joke about it. You know, it's like, and we got that thing going. And I think the last thing Tom said to me before I left, he's like, man, it's a real shame we got to leave this fire behind. This thing, this came out really nice. So we got that. And it was funny because, like, I had been my wife jokes at me for watching all these survival series TV shows. And I'm like, man, I love that stuff. And I'm walking around and I'm so dehydrated from all this. I'm like drinking water out of the moss piles and all this stuff, which I think later on gave me Giardia, but I don't know. At the time it was a good idea.
You were drinking out of the stream too for a bit.
Yeah, that's right. I drank out of the stream too. I was like, oh man, I can't take this anymore. So our Poplin rescue team showed up, and they came walking out, and they carried me back to camp with Tom. And we get back there, and they're just like, you know, telling basically the story of, you know, we're joking when we were there, and still joking that they're probably still talking about these two white guys coming into their town, you know. We said the night the Boulay came for dinner, Tom?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, and we got back in there, and then they started asking us, you know, what we were doing, and they were just like, they couldn't believe it that we walked that 7-hour hike up through that. And they're like, oh my gosh, you know. But we got back and in one piece, almost not, and kind of started going through some of the footage a little bit. I was afraid to do anything with it because I didn't want to risk, you know, anything happening to it. And so we started looking at the pictures, and then we were just like sitting there just kind of looking at each other like, you've got to be kidding me. It's like, we just did what?
Nobody else has ever done.
It was incredible. Like, I mean, it was absolutely the most incredible experience I've ever had working with these animals. I mean, just sitting there, you kind of lose track of what's going on, what's reality when you're seeing this, because you're like, oh my God, everything that's led up to this point is just like, what else possibly could you take in? And you're just like looking at this snake and you're just like, holy crap. And she's sitting on these eggs and you're just like, wow, there's baby bolens in there. It's like, this is insane. And there's more nests. Good God, they do breed. You know,
wow.
It's like, so,
we're collecting all those great data. So.
Oh yeah. Tom was just plugging stuff away constantly. And, we were just flip-flopping, you know, it's like, okay, you hold the camera, I'll hold the camera, you know, and rotating and just trying to think of every possible scenario around us and recording everything. And we were watching, like, checking out the plants and checking out the substrate, checking out inside the nest. And, you know, the nest was whether it was this particular nest that she chose, because typically they'll take over the couscous, which they feed off, you know, consistently up there. They take off these couscous nests, which are these terrestrial mammals, but can be in the trees. And they just will take over their nest and go in there and, you know, basically take over. And we started getting up to the nest, and Tom's like, look, there's scat. And I'm like, okay, so we're close because we're finding bolen scat. And then I think when I pulled the female out, there was an eggshell in there prior too, which I was talking – we were both talking to one of the guys, and he was saying that the females will come back or use the same nest over and over. Whether or not that's just their observation or if it's actually the truth, it was really interesting to hear it and be able to find eggshells to back it up. So it was unbelievable. Just absolutely unbelievable. And then we stayed down in the village for, I think, 2 days. And then after that, we kind of gathered up all our stuff and head back down. And I think it was, we had to get a four-wheel drive. They had like these people that were delivering rocks up into the mountains come and get us because the roads were so bad.
It was a road crew, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
And so these big old trucks came, they with chains on their wheels, came pick us up, and we waited 2 days to get out of there, and we load up, and a bunch of Poplins jump on the back of the truck for a free ride again, and we drive through this just disgusting mess, and, you know, it was supposed to be a – what did they say? It was another 3 hours, Tom, or something?
Yeah. which
it's like 3 hours, which turned into we left at 3 p.m. We got back at like 1 a.m.
Oh, man.
Right.
We had a
long 3 hours.
Yeah.
We had a vehicle. We had a vehicle get stuck. We had to pull out the vehicle. We blew out a tire. I mean, it was incredible. We're filming this whole thing because one of the big things that we're going to do for this new book is we're going to include a DVD in the back that's going to have like the whole trip on it. So basically,
fantastic.
if you can't make it to New Guinea, all you got to do is pick up a book and you can. You know, so it's a
cool.
That's awesome.
And it's just incredible, like seeing this stuff. And we get into. We get back down into Wilmina and, sit down and try to get everything going. And I think what it was, we got in at like 1 a.m. It's like immediately like ran for some food, something besides eating sweet potatoes and what else was it? And noodles. And I think we, and pot meat. So we had some, what was it? Chicken and the hairy meat or whatever it was. I kept calling it the hairy meat. Had like some hairy fibers in it, man. It tasted like meatloaf. It was awesome, but God only knows what it was. It's horrible. But then we, it's like I think I clogged up the drain in that bathroom about 4 or 5 times with all the mud coming off of us, and it was horrible. Like we tried to sneak in there at night, you know, in this place, and these huge trails of mud everywhere.
Huge tracks of mud back to our hotel room.
It was horrible. We left extra money just for them for that.
Yeah, we should.
So you guys have to go up and down every single time you would go up into the mountains? Like, you just don't stay up there in the mountains? Wow.
No, you can, but on this trip, I mean, our goal was to get this, was to go up for a nest. So, I mean, obviously when you come in, I mean, in that elevation, there's nothing really up there besides the bolens and this potential, you know, scrub python that, you know, the oxbill at that elevation, but not in the area we're at. So unless you're there, I mean, that's the only reason you go up there is for the bolen eye.
Right, right.
Yeah. Okay. So.
Now, was it already known that they make nests or use nests, like, in the ground?
Yeah, the prior information that we had, and then which is in Black Python book, was that they utilize these nest areas that they basically take over burrows similar to that couscous in these rocks and in these kind of limestone areas rather. But in this scenario, it was just different. It was very different from what I had perceived and what I had heard and seen photos of. And it could have just been this area was isolated enough that they basically just decided to do it this way as opposed to that, but there wasn't any limestone where we were at or any rock. Hmm. This was up at the top of the mountain in like almost a little valley area, I'd say.
Right.
I mean, would you be able to describe it any different, Tom? It was just like a real...
No, it was like a little oasis of woodland in between the mountains.
Yeah, it was like right between, like, so we're at the top and it's like kind of like a bowl nestled in the middle. But there was we were not hanging off any cliffs on this stuff. And, I mean, the areas were steep, but it wasn't rock steep. It was just vegetation just kind of hanging. But it was a really odd, peculiar place. The vegetation was the same, and a little bit of the geography was the same. But as far as where we found this nest, it was different from what I'd perceived prior.
Okay.
Huh. It's funny how they would just choose a different scenario, kind of like just a...
Yeah, it was, like I said, it was off. It was not the typical from what I'm used to talking about with it. And that's why I was like, you mean, it's right here? And he's like, yeah, it's right here. And I'm like, I'm digging in a fallen log.
Are
I'm
you
in the middle
sure?
of this little cove. Yeah, I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Wow. So,
So did you get to see any other nests or just the one nest?
Well, when we came in, we found Tom and I actually found another nest, but nobody was home. Whether or not it was a place for, you know, other animals to be in, or if just the couscous was in there, nobody took it over. But when we came back, it was identical to basically what we found. So we photographed it too and checked it out, and it was really interesting as well. I mean, it was this big couscous den, but just nobody was in there. So I don't know if it was an abandoned nest or if it just never worked out or if it just didn't have the right parameters that they were looking for to be able to maintain, a nest, so to say, or anything like that. But the information we got, it was really interesting. a lot of this
stuff. It was a little more open. It was that nest was a little bit more open than the other one, so maybe she wouldn't be able to control the temperature as well for some reason, and just, you know.
Yeah.
Wasn't it enough of a controlled environment where she can incubate the eggs at a temperature?
Okay.
Right. Okay.
Cool.
Yeah.
So, this book, when, I know I'm probably jumping the gun here, but when can we expect the book to be out? So.
It'll be soon. It'll
okay.
be soon. This will be Tom and I and our good friend Danny Gunnelin will be are putting this together. So we're trying to get this thing wrapped up pretty quick. We've got we're pretty far into it already. So we've been working on it for about a little over a year now. And then with this last trip, we got a lot more information. It's going to be different as opposed to the first one. It's going to be very heavy anecdotal, which will be really cool because it'll focus more on observations from prior naturalists, biologists, herpetologists and stuff. I've got some people like Carl Switek that's going to be contributing, like real old school herpers. Dick Ross mentioned he was going to be incorporating something as well. And it'll basically go through like these people's first observations of these snakes and what they've experienced with them. And like all the really early great stories that we all love to hear about when they're seeing these animals in the wild or working with them in captivity. And then it'll go from there, as well as a lot of stories, from Tom and I. Some of them I can't even remember right now. be incorporating in there too, like the Popwin death bug. You know, that's a great one. And
the dreaded Popwin death bug.
The dreaded Popwin death bug. That's right.
Full name,
right.
Please.
And then it'll go into more of an updated kind of where we are, captive husbandry stuff, as well as observations from the nests that we located, the one nest we located, and then. Information from the locals and stuff like that too, which all the new stuff they were telling us about. That there's kind of some eye-opening things that maybe help us out. Certainly, completely changed my view on the species as far as how they are and what they do. I mean, when people say they're a specialized python, they really have no idea. I mean, these snakes are very in tune with what they are doing in their environment, unlike, in my opinion, other snakes with what they're doing. And it'll just be another chance for us to really share that in this book. And then it'll also have a DVD in it, like I said, that'll encompass, like, the trip and then video of the nest and the video of the eggs and all that stuff, too.
And we got some great aerial footage.
We got some crazy stuff flying in and just, the adventure getting there. And it's been killer because, you guys know, I'm more than willing and want to share any and all data and photographs, but like I have not been able to show these pictures of these eggs yet, which is killing me because I want to save them for the book.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my God, I was like, you're killing me, Tom's like, don't you dare, don't show it. So it's like, so I'm like, okay.
Wow.
Oh man, that's awesome. So what would be the, can you give us a little teaser of like what have you learned, how do you look at the species different?
Socially, I think they're very unique. And I think they're very different from what we're in, how we perceive them now. I don't think it's just, python to python kind of stuff. I think there's a lot more involved in just the reproductive aspect as well as biologically too. We're getting reports don't kill me, Tom, for telling some of this stuff, but I got to. we're getting reports from the locals, these animals utilize, and we knew that they, utilize these nests over and over, but the females will utilize them, clutch after clutch after clutch, which is kind of weird. Anticipating on a snake. Typically there's not a lot of snakes that will utilize the same area, really, especially a large python like this. The other thing is just with how the other snakes incorporate themselves around the females when they're gravid. You know, we were sitting there. One of my biggest things is I'm always like trying to talk to these hunters to find out, you know, what they're observing, you know, when they're observing it, if there's anything that seems odd. But it's always difficult because the way they perceive things compared to how we perceive it can be taken differently. So, you know, I take a lot of what they tell me in a grain of salt, but a lot of it, I mean, I always write it all down. And then Tom and I will kind of go over it and say, you know, could this really be, you know, legit, or is this just, you know, way out there? But some of it, like the babies, you know, residing in the nest for several weeks prior to exiting the nest to go down a lower elevation, which is odd to me because I'd be like, why would they want to stick around? I mean, and you know, it's like one of those things like, okay, well, you know, okay, they're not really telling the truth or, you know, blah, 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 but they are because they know when to go collect them. So,
right.
You know, they would know. Also, were, you know, males, I asked them, you know, it's like, are there always males cruising around? They said, well, you know, males are always cruising around looking for females when it's breeding time, but, you know, all the other snakes stay away from the nest sites when the female has eggs. And I'm like, okay, that's kind of a weird observation. Why would you say that? And I'm like, well, you know, well, could, probably because she's not putting off any pheromones, you know, they don't want to be around there or something like that, too. And she's got all those, you know, biological markers of scat and urate and shed and all that around her nest site. So, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, when you compare it to a lot of other species, especially Morelia, there's not a lot of other snakes that do this kind of stuff. And, I mean, as well as being one of the factors of why we can't reproduce them successfully in captivity. That's, I think, the biggest thing. I mean, you know, my friend Nick told me, he's like, you know, they're a python. They should breed like a python. But, for whatever reason, we can't figure it out or why they're not wanting to really get to that point in captivity. I don't know if we'll know that, but hopefully we'll be able to better understand with, you know, trips like this and being able to talk to people and, you know, kind of get their idea and their views on the subject as well as, you know, stuff like this. So,
is there anything that they're doing different at the farms that would be different in the wild? Like, aren't they breeding them at farms over there?
Well, there's one farm, our friend, Danny has reproduced them twice at his farm. He's, building another farm right now. So they, hadn't focused anything really on the reproduction stuff currently, just because all their energy is going to building the new facility. I mean, as far as what they did, a lot of it, is similar, but there's some different factors also that are very different from what we're doing. And then also some of it is, how I've always said, how we pay attention to certain detail, they pay attention to detail different as well.
Right.
So something that would be so obvious, as to, you know, the worker was only smoking this brand of cigarettes for 2 months when the population was going on, as opposed to, you know, something else, you know, would be, you know, not noticed to them. So there's different things that they're doing, you know, the rain cycle, different introduction stuff. And without telling too much of it, you know, as far as what we've kind of come up with on an idea, Tom and I have kind of sat down when we got back and I basically had to be dragged around because my legs were like mush. We kind of came up with an interesting breeding strategy that we're going to try out. It seems pretty legit. I mean, as far as realistic-wise is what can be accomplished and just from what we've gotten in it. I mean, we're not far off from what everything's going on. It's just there's a couple little tweaking things that need to be done, I think, that can help out. I don't know. Do you have anything, Tom, to add on that or –
No, well, the facility that we're building is going to be it's around 2,000. I was helping to build it when I was there. About 2,000 square foot. We're going to have air conditioning. We're going to be able to manipulate temperature to wherever we want.
Yep.
And we're going to have a nice founder stock. We got about 20, yeah, at least 20 animals that we're going to start with.
Yep.
See if we can introduce, manipulate some cues and see if we can get them to go.
Oh, wow. Cool.
That's fantastic.
Are you going to have your those thoughts of what you think as far as breeding in the book, or is that going to be?
Yeah, definitely. Oh, no, yeah. It's going to be a tell all. I mean, I'm not going to hold anything back. I never really do. So, but it's like except for the pictures I took, I let a couple of them sneak out. We're going to really go through a lot. Like I said, it's going to have a lot of first section of this book's going to cover a lot of stories and observations from people in the past to current, and then we're going to go through updated data and then cover stuff that we observed in the wild just recently and then from the last trip as well. And I'm going to put all those observations as well as all the stories from the locals because, you know, maybe if there's something in there that I miss not to look at, but I write it down, somebody picks it, and they utilize it differently, that might work. So I definitely want to be able to incorporate everything and anything that I think could help out.
Awesome.
Cool. I'm so looking forward to the book. I know there was a little sneak peek of the, I guess it was the video that you posted over on that
blog. Oh, yeah, I like teasing everybody real good at that stuff.
that was really cool. If you didn't see it, you can go see it. Over. It's on the Bolin's Facebook page, right?
Yeah, it's on my Bolin's Facebook page, and I'm trying to think where else. I don't think I have it posted anywhere else, but I'll post it up. It's like I said, we got so much. I mean, we had so much. I think it took almost 1,000 photographs.
Awesome.
And I still was wishing I took certain things. It's like you always do that though when you're on a trip. You're like, oh God, I wish I had done this. But I mean, it's not our last trip. I mean, we're already planning to go back out again. And Tom's heading back out to Jakarta probably the next month or so. You know, because he's going to
be back out there.
Yeah,
I'll be back next month, and then hopefully I'll be back in Papua because I want to video the snakes in that one nest hatching actually too. So
yeah, well, that's what we're going to try to get that in the book. So Tom will be back up there, and then. And then I'll head back up to meet Tom and then kind of go from there. And then we're going to take really kind of sit down and try to figure out a good breeding strategy for what Tom and Danny can utilize at the facility out there for Danny's new farm. So see if we can go from there. But, yeah.
That would be very cool to catch the same babies to hatch out. Now,
right.
With them reusing the nest over and over again, does that mean that the Bolins have a, dare I say it, a home range?
I put it in the first book where they were having like these kind of areas like that they would reside in. It's like, you know, it has everything that they need to, require them to be comfortable and be able to reproduce, you know, within the size of like basically like roughly like a football field, I think. But, they definitely – they're not, in my opinion, a cruising species by any means. I think they basically set up shop, and that's where they're at. I think the males are obviously going to be a little bit more cruising, but they're still going to stay in the home territory range.
Right.
Because they have access to food, they have access to females, they have everything they need, as opposed to some of the other larger constrictors that just cruise and look opportunistically for anything they can find.
Right.
But I definitely feel strong that these guys are kind of like a sit-up shop and kind of hangout area species, especially for, like, from the past data where, you know, we've, you know, photographed areas where they're at, and you can see, like, all the scat and the shedding that they're leaving behind around. So basically saying, you know, these are my areas, you know, don't come over my spot.
Right. Well, how far was the displacement between your nests? Like, did you guys have to pretty much hike pretty far to get between nest to nest?
I don't know on this one because we were only able to see that one nest that had the eggs and the female on it. But they were all in the vicinity. Tom, do you remember? I think he said it was like a couple hours apart from each one or something. Or
no, not even that far.
It was like in a loop or something.
Right, nest to nest probably within, I don't know, half an hour, 40 minutes of each other.
Okay.
And they were all kind of like in this circular kind of area, like kind of this gorge almost in a way.
Right.
Huh. That's really cool, and I am definitely envious of both of you guys. I know you don't believe me being that you were like, you know, waist deep in mud and guck and all that other crap, but God, sign me up. Be awesome.
Well, we've been, you know, we've had a lot of people recently asked, you know, about this trip. It's like, hey, we want to go out with you. You know, how can we go out? We've kind of been tossing the idea about, you know, taking some people out there and be able to experience some stuff, you know,
right.
And do that. But we're still kind of thinking about how to do it just because of just accessing some of these areas. And just it's really difficult as well as time-consuming. It's expensive, and it can be dangerous. I mean, this last time I fell down a 15-foot embankment into a river that was fed out through the mountain.
Right.
And I almost cracked my head on a big boulder. So, and then I had a face full of Papuan crotch as I went down. So, and then we had the dreaded Papuan death bug to deal with. So, I mean,
right.
I mean, it's not a trip for everybody, but, we were toying around. I got a friend, Paul, that's been wanting to go, and a friend Brian that wants to go. And, I know Tom's got some buddies that have been talking to him also, and we just kind of thinking of how we're going to do it. You know, definitely it'll probably be after we get this book finished, because all the time is going into that. And then if we need to get back out again to get some more data or anything like that, we'll go from there. But it really, you know, puts a lot of things in perspective when you get to see it at this kind of an angle. Like I've always, you know, dreamed. It's hokey as it sounds. I've always dreamed about seeing, you know, bolens on eggs, you know, whether it be from a snake that I was lucky enough to breed or one in the wild, and we did it. And we found one and saw it and photographed it and touched it, and that's it, man. It's just, that's it. You know, it's I don't think much can top that, except for Tom dangling the video of the babies hatching out of the eggs over my head when he comes back. So,
that'll be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, then we'll be able to see if they actually do stay in the nest, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's one of the other cool things.
I'll be spending, you know, as long as it takes, I'll be spending there to, you know, watch that. Let's make the hatch.
See if they actually
record and see what they do.
And, the nice thing is the people that we're with that took us to these areas are very very gracious, and they're very keen on helping us out for the project we're working on. So they're, you know, we always have a welcome to come back, which was great. It was funny because one of my biggest, I'm getting stories that are coming to my head now. We were sitting around the fire, and one of the things I'm real interested in is the folklore involved with the snake, because, you know, some snakes have folklore, some don't. And I spoke to Mark O'Shea, who's I speak to on occasion, and he's always been very helpful in answering my questions, and he gave me some really interesting folklore around in PNG and a little about Erie and what, you know, West Papua. And so I asked him, and this tribe, I don't even remember the tribe we were with. I don't think it was Donnie at all. It was somebody else. There's so many different tribes that are out there. Yeah, it was a different than Donnie. I asked him, like, you know, what about, they knew about the snake right away. And aside from, you know, one of the guys that, you know, watches them, they told me that the snake is a ghost. It's like a spirit. And they said that the snake, when people die, that the snake comes down to get the souls of these people that takes them back up into the mountains with them.
That's cool.
That was pretty cool. And then what really kind of was cool was I have a good friend of mine tattooed a Bolens python on my whole left arm. And I lifted up my shirt, and they flipped out when they saw it. And I wish I had a photograph of them looking at it, but I think I've got video from Tom. And they were checking it out, and right when they saw that, they were just like, oh, my God. So I think that kind of helped out a little bit with them realizing, you know, how important these things are to us.
Right.
And what we were there to do, and what we were able to achieve and gain from this trip and being able to interact with them, which was great. So I think the rest of the night we just stayed up, and they told us stories and just laughed about things. And it was just a phenomenal trip. I mean, it couldn't have been any better. And everybody asked when I was coming back, you know, they're like, how was it? I'm like, I can't even describe. Can't even describe. It was,
wow.
So.
I know. I think I was headed into work. I don't even know what time it was. Like 5 o'clock in the morning or something like
early.
That. And I'm headed into work, and I was like, "Wow, this day's gonna suck." And then you sent me a text message, and I was
"Yeah, I think I was in Jakarta. I was in Jakarta when I sent that to you. I was like, I gotta tell Eric."
That was awesome.
Yeah, Eric tells me, and I'm like, he's like, Ari sent me this. I'm like, son of a bitch.
Yeah, I was like, oh gosh, yeah, here we go.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
very cool. So are you going to apply this to your breeding season starting now that you're going
to? Well, I mean, in the wild, we've got eggs getting ready to hatch. So, I mean, in the States, you know, we're gearing down towards, you know, intros and stuff and cooling down right now. So, you know, I'm just kind of letting my guys and the animals at the zoo kind of do their thing right now, and then I'm going to really dive into a little bit later. So that way I can really kind of sit down with Tom and kind of think of something, think of some different areas to do it with the captive stuff as opposed to the wild. So I'm going to let everybody do their routine this year as normal, you know, and continue how I've been doing it, and seeing if anything happens or if I get lucky, as you know, more or less. And then when we come out of everything, just start reattempting there with the new regiment.
I'm curious, is like when you were talking earlier, you said about the size of this female. Now, I know most of the people that I've talked to about bones pythons, and the same with scrubs, is that they keep them on the lean side.
Man,
you
this
think
thing
that
was
that
gigantic.
Something to do with it?
Oh, my God, this thing was – I was extremely surprised. I mean, I've got big bones at home. I've got big bones at work. And when I mean big, I'm talking about, you know, like a 7 to 9 foot snake. That's a big snake if you have, I mean, and then you've got a decent body size of that animal to, you know, correspond proportionally to it. This snake, when I pulled out, and Tom has been working with reptiles, God knows how, I don't even know how old Tom is. He's been looking for reptiles forever. And when he gasped and said, oh, God, I knew that this was a big snake when I was pulling her out. And I was just like, and the local was looking at me like, you've got to be crazy. You're pulling the snake out. And I'm like, yeah, I'm pulling it out. I'm here, duh. And when I got her out, I was like, "You." I mean, I had half of her out, and she still had half of her in the nest.
Jeez.
She was huge. This snake was like the grandmother of all bones, but she was an old snake too. That was the other thing. She had at least been in her 20s. I mean, this was an old snake, but she was pristine looking, but she had that kind of old look to her that you could tell she's been around for a while.
Right. Right. Hmm. Interesting.
Good thing you didn't get tagged by her.
You know, I reached in right before I said, Tom, I'm going to get tagged. And I stuck my hand in there and I started pulling her. She didn't even care. Took her out. She kind of got a little head spaz on me where she kind of moved real quick when I had her out. And then I just kind of did my stuff and fed her back in there. And she was – but the thing that would just – I keep getting to was just how solid and mass she was after laying those eggs. Because they were decent-sized eggs. They're like a good-sized carpet python egg. And she had at least 15 eggs in that clutch.
Right.
And they were this big mass, this giant mass that she was wrapped completely around. And the mass probably stood, I'd say, oh, God, probably like a good 8 or 9 inches high. And she was just giant. I mean, she looked like you filled her up full of, you know, that hairy meat. She was just solid. She was just, I was like, there's no way. I was expecting to see some kind of indentation in her or anything like that, but she was just packed.
Huh. That makes me think about that. That's interesting.
Yeah, and her head was just giant. I mean, God, her head was – I was like, good God, Tom, look at her head. I was like, oh, God, please don't bite me because this is going to really hurt. I was like, this is going to be bad. But she was like – her head was like a good 2 to 3 inches across. She was a big snake.
Do you think that any of the problems that we're having with breeding can be linked to maturity? Or do you think we're trying them too early?
You know, the maturity aspect, the sexual maturity stuff has always been kind of a question, excuse me. Let me get a drink of water here. My throat's killing me. Much better. The sexual maturity conversation has always been brought up as far as, you know, when do we know these animals are reaching their prime, or, you know, do they have to be very old to reproduce successfully? And a lot of people debate whether or not the animals initially have to be at older age because they come from a cooler area, so they mature slower. I don't think anybody knows, honestly. I've recorded follicular development in a 4.5-year-old female via ultrasound and behavior. Could she reproduce? Sure. She was, you know, reproductively showing signs. Would they? I don't know. That's the other thing. I've also gotten follicular development in an animal that's 21 at the zoo. So I don't really know. I don't think that the age plays as critical of a role as we thought before. I think there's different factors that are playing more of a role that once we put them all together, and it's not just one, in my opinion. I think there's several things that have to be tied and linked together to be able to get success. And even with that, I do not think in captivity that we'll be reproducing these things every year.
Huh.
Hmm.
Now, I have to ask this question. Did you guys see any other Morelia when you were over there?
We did not. I mean, we saw some awesome stuff at our friend Dave's farm, but besides that, nothing at that elevation.
I have in the past, but this trip, no, we did not.
Yeah, Tom's seen lots of stuff on his prior trips, but not at this one. At this elevation and where we were at, I mean, this is as far in as I have ever been, and we were out there. We were, what was one of the guys talking about the Fojo Mountain discovery with all those Nat Geo animals? We were like, I think maybe hours away from that site or close to that range. So we were way, way in. There's not much up at that elevation except for the Bolins.
Wow.
Right. I just always wondered, like, isn't it like the chondros are kind of on the ground level and the scrubs are kind of in between the Bolins and the chondros? Isn't that kind of how it...
you've got better experience on those guys than I do.
It can be. There's lower elevation chondros, there's mid-elevation chondros, and there's actually even high-elevation chondros. MS-15s are somewhere in the middle. And Bolins are obviously at the very top, 10,000 feet plus. So,
yeah.
Wow. That's cool.
Right. Awesome. Oh man, I'm sorry. I'm having trouble with my.
I've never heard you guys so quiet before.
Well, it's trying to,
I know. I'm like.
I'm kind of picturing it myself, so it'd be a. I'm off in a day. So, the computer.
Yeah, my microphone is screwed up here, so I'm like going in and out. There, I'm back in.
Okay.
Sorry.
No problem.
Yeah, I don't even know where to.
I told you it was gonna be a good radio thing, Eric.
Yeah,
you weren't going to be able to come up with any questions.
I can't even imagine, like, what, I mean, that, to me, well, I got to say first, it's like, I mean, you talk about dedication to a species. I mean, that's pretty much the ultimate dedication to a species.
Thank you. I mean, thank you for that. I mean, Tom and I, it's like, we love doing what it is we do. I mean, it's, I've been working with these snakes for so long, and it's such a passion of mine, and I enjoy every second I have with it. And then being able to, be able to share with a friend of mine like Tom and be able to enjoy it together where we're actually, there doing it and just taking it in for what it is. I mean, it's so much more than seeing a snake on eggs. It's like, we were, as hokey as it sounds, it's like we were given the opportunity just to see it. And it's, and I'll never forget that. It's just, it was incredible. We were able to do it together, which was great. And be able to share it with everybody, which is the other important thing, that I'm very passionate about, is being able to share the experiences and all the information we get and these stories and stuff. I think that really, really sums it up.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to thank you guys for, coming on and sharing with us and giving us the opportunity to hear about this stuff. But, I just, like I said before, I love the first book. I can't wait till the second book comes out.
It's going to be great. It's going to be great. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be a lot of fun to put this stuff together and get these stories and then these photographs. And I'm trying to think of some... God, we had so many funny things happen to us when we were there. What was that guy's name that picked us up in the truck, Tom, that with the big mullet?
Oh,
Joe Dirt.
Yeah, The Indonesian Chuck Norris.
Yeah, the Indonesian Chuck. We call him Rick Norris. he was a real control freak. He wouldn't let me roll my damn window down in the truck, and I was overheating in the truck. He kept rolling it up on me. Got just so many funny little things that we just sit there and we just laugh so hard about on these trips. And this one's kind of a gross story, but it's pretty funny actually. I'll tell it. So during the course, and my buddy James, who's listening right now, asked me if I was going to tell the story. So yes, James, I'm going to tell the story.
Nice.
As I was drinking the water from the mountains because I was completely dehydrated, I developed some kind of stomach bug, and there was nothing solid about me at all for the rest of the trip. It was it was rough, and so Tom and I are at this house, and it was that we're staying at the mountain. It's like, it was a really nice, like, you know, built house that they built out there. And I mean, when I say house, it's like, you know, wood thatch, you know, up above the ground with holes in the ground, you know, you crap in the holes or whatever. And there's like a little room in there. And it's, you know, there's a fire in the living, you know. So this is pretty primitive stuff. So they gave us, I guess,
the
suite.
The pigs were living underneath the house.
Yeah, the pigs were under the house and everything. So every middle of the night you hear this. Wee!
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah, this is, I mean, we're not staying at a Hilton when we're doing this. This was probably the nicest little hut we stayed in out there. We're roughing it when we're out there, and these pictures show it. And we get there, and they gave us, I guess, the main room, and it was like this little foam pad that was about an inch, and Tom and I slept on this pad. And by that time, we could slept anywhere just because of what we went through. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and man, my stomach was rolling so bad. It was horrible. And I asked Tom, I'm like, Tom, it was like, you know, where do I go to the bathroom? And he's like, oh, pee out the window. And I'm like, I don't have to pee. I'm like, I was like, and he's like, oh, God. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to go try to find the bathroom or somewhere I can go. So I went outside, and a lot of times they'll have areas where all the tribe or the locals will go, and that's their spot where they go to the bathroom. And it's pitch black outside. I mean, I'm in the middle of New Guinea, and it's pitch black. It's 60 degrees out. It's got a light rain.
Pitch
I'm
black.
Cold.
There's no electricity. There's no
nothing.
Running water. It's pitch black.
It's pitch black. Oh. So I open the – and there's all these top ones that are passed out, and I'm stepping over them to get outside, you know, and I'm trying to be all quiet, and I open the door, and I walk outside, and I'm like, man, I got to go. I was like – I'm walking out there, and I'm like, all right, I think this is a good spot. And I brought toilet paper with me from the hotel in Jakarta because I knew I was going to need it. I was like, there's no way because, you know, they use – whatever, they use their left hand, and they wash it. That's why you don't shake hands with the left hand, because it's considered an insult in Indonesia, yada yada. Anyway, so I got my toilet paper in my hand, got it in my jacket, you know, so it doesn't get all wet. And I get out there, and I get down, and I'm just like, oh my God, it's like the scene from Dunham and Dumber when he's sitting on that toilet, and it's just like horrific. And I'm just like, oh my God, this is horrible. And I do my business, and I think I'm okay. And I'm like, okay, this is great. And I sneak back in, and Tom's like, so did you go? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, you find a spot? I'm like, yeah, I found a spot. So then we wake up in the morning, everything's fine. I'm getting her to go outside and go to the bathroom, and I'm like, man, I wonder where I went and took a crap. And I was like, because I thought I walked off far enough. Well, I go out there, and dead. And the way the town, this little area was set up, there's like a little hut to the left, a hut on the right, a hut in the middle. So it's kind of like a little square in the middle, but it was just like, I mean, middle of nowhere. Sure enough, my luck, I took a crap right in the middle of the square, and there's this big pile of toilet paper sitting in the middle of the square, and I'm just like, oh, my God.
Oh,
like,
great.
Do you think they knew it was me?
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, that was my contribution. But nobody said anything to me, so which made me feel good, so. It was good. And then afterwards, they showed me where the bathroom was. So
that's nice of them.
Yeah. They're like, oh, these stupid white guys. They always crap in the middle of our town.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so it was pretty good.
Weird problem.
That's my gross story.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking at some of the pictures on the Bolin's Facebook page. Now, the one you have in the where you're in the village that you stayed in, looks like you're in there. That's kind of like what you're talking about, right? That's kind of what they're
Yeah, I think it's a shot where I'm wearing my green sweater.
Yep.
Yeah, that's like inside the hut.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And it's funny, too, because here's a funny one for you also. Because, like, I mean, they're using like you know, sticks to move like the stones to heat up the fire. And, you know, they're heating up this old rusty pot with water in it, and they're everything is very traditional, very, you know, non-modern by any means. There's no electricity. And I turn around and everybody pulls their cell phone out and is looking on Facebook. And it's like they're asking if I've got a Facebook account. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me.
How did you do this?
Wow.
I'm like,
no,
are you serious? Yeah, it's like they've got a cell phone. Everybody pulls a cell phone out and they're looking on their Facebook account. It's like,
wow.
You've got to be kidding me.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so it was a...
What about the picture of the, I guess you want to say it's like the mountain cliff there.
Yeah, that's one of the spots. That was what we looked at when we woke up. That was one of the areas we saw. So we were in the middle of that, basically.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that village is surrounded by those mountains.
By those crazy-looking mountains.
Yeah. It looks like Jurassic Park almost.
It is.
Wow.
Look out for the pile of toilet paper in the middle of the.
Yeah, you got to watch for
there.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see. There's also the picture. You got the. I didn't see this one. There was the one where you're actually digging in the nest. I saw the one at the nest, but.
That's where we're at the nest, and we're digging in there. So, and then there's a shot I think I posted also of that empty nest where I'm pointing in the hole.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
And then there's some of the plants and such.
Yeah, it's just crazy, the ferns and everything, and then the pitcher plants and all that crazy stuff.
That's good stuff. Now, where's the – where you're taking your 7.5-hour hike?
Oh, God. I got 7.5 hours of photos of it. I'll post up – I can post one of those up this evening to see kind of like what it looks like. It's just like this mud – slop, but it's like they cut through the sides of these mountains to make access. Because weren't you saying, Tom, that they're making a road like through Wamina to the other side to Jayapura or something? Or
yeah, they were doing the Trans-Syrian Highway. I don't know how far they. I think just people were dropping like flies because of malaria.
Yeah, which you potentially have right now, correct?
I do have, not potentially.
Nice.
Oh no.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah.
So yeah, but the Trans-Syrian they kind of forgot there's the second largest mountain range in the next to the Himalayas in Asia running through the New Guinea, and they kind of forgot that the mountain range was there and had to stop building the highway from Jayapura all the way down to Morocco.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Oh man. So, all right. Got any other crazy stories for us, or?
I don't. Tom, you got anything on there? I'm trying to think of all the.
I'm still a little bit delirious at this point, so.
Is it because of the malaria, or are you just thinking back to the trip?
Just a little bit of both.
Yeah, a little bit of both. We got back. We were able to photograph the Xenoderma javanicus. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that one.
No.
The dragon scale snake.
Oh, really?
Yes. Oh, my God.
Yes.
They're awesome.
Yeah, we photographed. We found two of those. It was two. Two of those we found. We photographed those also. So I'll post a picture for you guys to drool over.
Yeah, those things are wicked looking.
Yeah.
Yeah, those.
Yeah,
we found those on Java about 4 hours outside of Jakarta.
Yeah, it was pretty sweet.
Yeah. Wow. That's awesome.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All right, so... I don't know. I don't know if I have any other questions.
They pretty much answered everything.
The questions
experience.
That I probably want to ask, you probably aren't going to be able to answer until the book
comes
out. So that's why I'm kind of...
it doesn't hurt to try, you know? Throw one out there. Let's see what happens.
I don't know. I guess it's like, you know, just the whole... I mean, now that you are, let me ask you this. Have you, just as far as keeping these pythons in captivity, are you going to do anything different after?
Not heavily personally. I'm going to continue maintaining what I'm doing. I might, I might change a little bit on just humidity wise and just rainfall or just the dampness.
Okay.
To an extent,
that's
that's
by design. I'm going to be trying to simulate
the nesting and the nesting site. When I say dampness, I'm not talking about super saturating, but just having that element of that being exposure being incorporated every so often. I mean, you don't obviously want to, when you compare an animal to captivity and wild, you have the access of the animal getting away and stuff like that too. So you don't want to promote any kind of unsanitary or, health related issues by doing something like that. But aside from that and the nesting, I think we're pretty close just to be able to simulate it. And now it's, it's so much more than just trying to be able to reproduce them. I think it bottles down now to just trying to understand them more. And I think that's the exciting part for me. I mean, of course it'd be fantastic to get eggs. I'd be lying to you if I said no, but I think it's more exciting right now with where Tom and I are at, where we're kind of trying to we're understanding them more now. And I think once we get to that point where we start bringing in more of that, then the reproduction stuff will be easy and it'll just kind of fall in our lap, I think.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. Like, one of my things that draws me to Morelia as the group in general is just what you just said. Like, I'm really fascinated in trying to figure them out. Like, it seems like some of them are, I'd say Scrubs, Bolens, Owen Pelly, all those are kind of like, unknown type of things,
Yeah, they still remain that way in today's day and age where we're unlocking secrets for all sorts of stuff. I mean, but there still remain a few that are considered, like this enigmatic species. But, I think before it was so much for me personally trying to figure out how to breed them. And up until the last several years and this trip, it became more of understanding about them more now, trying to understand their behavior and what they're about. And then, like I said, once we really start appreciating that and being open and exposed to their behavior naturally and what these things do and how incredible of a snake they are, then the rest will just kind of fall into place. And it'll be kind of figured out a little bit, I guess a little bit easier to kind of achieve that end result. But it's more about just the animal now.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think once whatever it is that comes along with the Bolens python, I think will be similar with the Halma Harris scrub.
Yeah, and there's some intent people working with some of the Halma Harris and they've done some great stuff with them. And I think it's going to be kind of like one of those similar scenarios where we have to really understand these animals for what they are and what they do before we can really kind of unlock that other chapter to figure out what's left, proceed from there.
Yeah. I was very excited to hear that the temp of the eggs was 85 degrees because we were at Tinley Park and Terry Phillip, I don't know if you know him or have heard him.
Yes, I've never spoken to Terry, but I've heard about Terry.
He gave a talk, and he was talking about thinking outside the box as far as his captive husbandry is. And he basically was saying that, his thoughts with Bolens, he doesn't keep Bolens, but, he was thinking that that 85 to 80 degree temperature is what they need. And to hear that that's where the eggs were when it was 60 degrees outside. Basically he was saying that you wouldn't need to drop them down to 60 degrees because they're trying to achieve that 80 degree temperature.
Well, I've never spoken to Terry before. I mean, I've always thought, in my personal opinion, that you didn't have to drop them past 60. I mean, 60, when you think about 60 degrees, it's relatively cool. Especially for a large snake to be exposed to. I never thought, initially, when you hear about Bolens python, you think, oh, it's cold weather python, and they are, because they maintain these areas where it gets relatively cool. And I've taken temperatures, in the upper 40s. Snakes aren't exposing themselves to that, but they're still kind of associated to that element. to an extent. I never really believed that they had to drop down past that, maybe upper 50s, but for certainly nothing prolonged because, like I said, I think on one of the other interviews you guys got me on, twisted my arm to come on, and I said if it was such an easy thing as a temperature deciding factor, we would have eggs everywhere.
True.
And
yeah.
And it's interesting to note a lot of times with the prior reproductions and before that, you know, temperatures were right around in the 60s when the animals were being exposed to. I think maybe one or two scenarios were lower than 60, and then even with the captive results in Jakarta. You know, Jakarta, Tom, what's the low in Jakarta get to? It's like
the low temperature in Jakarta at night?
Yeah.
Wow. It's still in the high 70s.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like, and Danny's facility was able to reproduce them twice.
I did them in Lembang in 92, and that's a lot cooler, and it was still in the mid-60s.
Yeah. So, I mean, with that being said, I feel like temperature obviously is going to be a factor to an extent, as with anything. But being solely relied upon to be able to say, you know, you have to drop into this, I don't feel that's going to be a deciding factor as far as if you're going to get eggs or not. And, you know, past reproductions have showed, you know, the eggs can, you know, incubate, you know, 87, 88 as well. Which would, you know, suggest, you know, they, I mean, they could. I mean, I don't see why not. I mean, the temperatures I got were 85 to, like, 87, I think it was, when I was kind of moving around
like,
the eggs.
And with the female wrapped around them, shivering,
yeah.
You know, she's going to bump up that by 2 to 3 degrees. So you're right
so
around
it's probably 80. Right around that 85 to 88 range kind of fluctuated, I'd say.
Right.
So.
Now, I know you had some thoughts on the UV. Do you think
my neck has some thoughts on some of that UV too. you can ask Tom. I looked like I stuck my head in a oven when I came out of those mountains.
Wow.
The UV readings were insane. Like, I've been working on this project for now 3 years, and where we're trying to basically see if these snakes will utilize separate light sources and for what reason, if we're able to determine. And it was great because we were able to get up to this spot where we were able to get a snake that was sitting still. Like last time we got a snake and, you know, we were able to get UV on it, but this is a different scenario because we got a snake that's just kind of hunkered down and sitting on eggs. So where she was at with the cloud cover and just the vegetation, she was not exposing herself to any UV, but the amount of UV that was up to this site was just incredible, like considered, you know, dangerous to to humans. I was getting ridiculous readings. I think like a normal day in Texas, like a sunny day would be like if you were reading like on a solar meter, like the 6.2, I think it is a 6.0 or something. I forget the model. It would be like a 4 to a 6.
Okay.
And that'd be normal. And then on a high day, let's see, and they say anything past, you know, anything 10 to 13 is considered, you know, excessive exposure.
Right.
And I was getting readings like into the 30s. Was insane. And I was getting like 560 nanowatts, I think, on one of my readers. And when I came back down, I had these giant – it looked like somebody took a knife and took a chunk out of skin off my back of my neck. I had actually – Tom was like applying this ointment and these gauze pads on my neck. because it was just like – just these open sores from just the UV exposure. My arms were burnt up and blistered out.
Wow.
So it was pretty intense. Now, whether or not they utilize – that UV, for whatever reason, they're exposed to it when they're out. We're seeing different – we could be seeing different results in captivity versus the wild, but regardless, they're being exposed to it in the wild on a daily basis, except for during that nesting time when they're, you know, in those burrows, or the nests, rather.
Is there any thoughts of them leaving the nest, or are they pretty much staying on that
nest? I think they mentioned that like the, sometimes the female will come out and bask real quick if she drops her temp or something, come back. I think I remember them saying that.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I mean, I didn't get the impression that she left just the way she was in there.
Okay.
She looked like she didn't want to go nowhere, and there wasn't evidence. I mean, aside from her going to take a dump outside the nest, you know, when she needs to, I don't think, you know, maybe bask, but I didn't get the impression that that she would leave her nest at all for anything.
Interesting. I'm trying to think what else.
That's another thing that we'd like to do is set up some even remote cameras and just photograph them throughout the entire incubation and see exactly what she does.
We've been tossing around a lot of new ideas as far as that.
Has there been any thoughts about radio tracking the ball?
We've talked about that. Realistically, to be able to do it would just involve, you know, somebody out there for, you know, entire year just to monitor the things, which in itself, you know, could be, you know, very difficult to an extent, time consuming by any means. So it's definitely a possibility. And I think we'd learn a ton of information from them if we were able to do that, just as far as what they do daily, how far they go from their nests. Do they stay in the same area like we're hoping they do or think they do? You know, do males cruise around looking for different females? Do they look for other males? You know, there's all sorts of different factors that would be really exciting to learn about.
Right. Wow.
Wow.
Well, if my work gives me off for the year, I will volunteer to do it.
Awesome. Send you up there.
No problem.
God. Hope you like sweet potatoes.
I could stand to lose a few pounds, no problem.
Nice. Yeah, I think I dropped like close to 10 pounds coming back, but most of that was left in the center of that town. So
yeah.
Eric, I got a question.
Come back like
for
a
you.
Mountain man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is not snake related, but how do you prep yourself for this type of? I mean, because it's very physical. So I mean, are you like getting in shape right before you go, or like?
I'm not the greatest in shape as it is. I could be a lot better without a doubt. You know, it's like I walk a lot, just working at the zoo. You know, my buddy and I walk about 3 or 4 miles a day, just on an average. But besides that, I mean, I think on my last trip, you know, I did a lot of hiking and, you know, hiked with my packs and stuff like that. Just kind of get my body and kind of, in the routine of expecting that carry, you know, all this excessive amount of weight. Take my 4-year-old on a walk and throw her on my back, you know, stuff like that.
Right.
But I mean, realistically, it's like, you know, it's different to be able to actually be there to prepare for something is, you know, then you're there. It can be very different. You're having to deal with all sorts of different elements that you normally wouldn't be exposing yourself to or training yourself to be able to deal with. So it's just really demanding. It's really mentally demanding as well. I think some aspect of it is more mental than physical, just in some of these places.
And sure. High altitude makes it a little tougher as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you play tennis all the time too, Tom.
Yeah, I do. I play a lot of tennis, and I'm actually not in too horrible shape. The way I train is I cut myself down from 3 packs to 2.5.
Yeah, nice. And then catch back up when we're at the top, right?
Yeah.
Nice. Well, I guess you must
and,
have you
and,
must
you
got
to cut back all your coffee drinking too.
Yeah.
Oh no. I guess you must have like the adrenaline take over a bit. I mean. I mean, you know, you're about to see bone pythons on eggs. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of, like, at that point, we were just, like, fatigued, and it just took over, and you were just, like, on overdrive, and it was just like, oh, my God. So, I mean, at that point, and then once we're like, okay, now we got to get back, you know, it's like, you know, I was ready to just sit there, lay down on the ground. I would have done that, but poor Tom was shivering and shaking, and I was like, we got to get out of here. And
wow.
Okay. Well, we're just about out of time. We're cool. Shining down on time, and I just want to, you know, thank you guys for coming on the show and sharing this with us. And I appreciate all the hard work that you're putting into this, you know, and then coming back and sharing with us. I think that's a huge plus for the Morelia community, you know.
Good deal.
So, you know, you guys are welcome here anytime.
Yeah.
You know, and
it's like Tom said, it's all good. Yeah, me, us too.
Yeah, I bet.
Us too. Like I said, it's our pleasure. Won't be the last time. You guys have been awesome. I enjoy coming up here. I'm glad I got Tom to come in, and I know this won't be our last time on the show.
Sure.
And as we continue to unlock more and more info on these guys and be able to observe stuff from them, you know, we'll continue to share it, and I'd love to be able to continue coming up here and this being an outlet to be able to do so everybody can hear it and have it and replay it and as many times as they want. So
yeah, I mean, shows like this really make it worthwhile for me, so you know.
Yeah,
I really do appreciate it, so
no problem.
Yeah, I hope you guys get better.
Yeah, I'll get a lot better quicker than Tom. I think Tom's had malaria before. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is number 4. So.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, well, tell them how you got it, though. That's the funniest part.
Oh, this trip, I can count on three fingers how many mosquito bites I got. And the one that I think got me and gave me the malaria this time was we were visiting a buddy in the hospital who actually did get malaria in the Asmat region. He was doing some White River turtle studies. Yeah, and the unlucky guy, he got both types of malaria in one hit, and we were in the hospital visiting him, and that's where I got mine, actually, in this nice little hospital room.
In the hospital? Wow.
Held by a malaria mosquito in the hospital room visiting a guy with malaria.
Awesome. Glad you're alive. Yeah. And makes some sense.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Shit.
Oh, man. So, well, I hope you guys are do better. And just make sure when the book comes out, you know, let us know so we can plug away. And
of course.
So I can get my hands on a copy of it. And I look forward to watching the DVD. And
yes. It's going to be great.
Seeing the picture.
Yeah, it'll be great. You definitely will enjoy it. So it's good times.
Cool. So just throw your website out there.
It's going to be MoreliaBolani.com. That's the easiest way, or ulahipam.com.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And you also have the Facebook page, the Bolens Python Group?
It's Morelia Bolani Group, Bolens Python Group, and it's on my Facebook page. And it's kind of just like an outlet for me to post up recent things going on, observations, photos, and I've got a nice group of, I think we've got about 100 plus people that are on it, and people from all over the world, and it's a good place for them to show their photos of their snakes on there too. And I encourage if you've got bowls to jump on there, and you know, to get on there and show your snakes and bring up some good questions, and it's a good place for us to brainstorm and come up with some ideas and just enjoy working with, you know, what we do.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
All right, guys. Well,
all right. You guys take it easy, all right? Yeah,
yep.
Yeah. Bye, Tom. I'll talk to you later.
All right. All right. Thanks.
See you.
Thanks for coming on.
No problem.
Well, there we go, Owen. That was packed full of information. And I can't stress enough, the dedication that these guys have to go up and go through all this.
Where plenty of people would have quit and gone home, they're like, we got to get up to see the Bolens in 24 hours, managing to go that far and to see them. I mean, like, you can imagine leaving at like 6 in the morning and you're still moving and still going and still going and still going. And then you see, like, I imagine that just kind of kick you into overdrive. But, I mean, then the trek down, I'm surprised they even were able to walk. I would have been like, well, that was awesome. So let's set up camp right over here, and I'll stare at the pile where she was for the next hour until I fall asleep. Then we'll worry about getting down off the mountain tomorrow. I mean, it's just the fact that you did all this just for the love of the species and just to get the knowledge about it is insane. And, you know, I deep respect for Ari and Tom for going out there and doing that. And that shit crazy. But,
yeah. Good
oh
for them.
God.
So when 5 years from now or 10 years from now, when you listen back to these episodes and you're breeding bowlands, pythons in captivity
because
of all
this
work.
Because they finally figured it out and it's like, you know, this is, oh, my fifth clutch this year and everybody's got bowlands and they're not popular and they can't sell yet. I mean, think about it, God damn it.
they're a beautiful species and I can't wait to work with them personally.
I just find it absolutely hilarious that in episodes like when Ari's on or Nick's on or people that have our wealths of information, you and I don't say a damn word.
Yeah, I know.
Like,
I love it.
It was like, Ari's like, so let me begin. And I'm like, okay. So like, I'm not going to comment. I might ask a few questions when he pauses, but I don't care. Go for it. So it's just like, you know, and you were the same way. It's like you would text me like once or twice during, if it's during a show, you and I will text back and forth instructions of what to do. So that we don't sound like complete assholes on the radio.
Yeah.
But this one is just like...
Nothing.
Nothing. Nothing at all. It's like, you might text me like once and be like, so, I'll be back. All right, I'm back. Okay. That was it. It's like, okay, this is fantastic. I love hearing about this stuff because I would love to go on a trek like this just to say I did it. And then, you know... We'll have to walk into Abington Hospital around the corner and be like, so I got malaria. What are you guys going to do about that?
What can you
and
do
watch the doctors be like, what? So, I mean, that would just be adding fun to it, but fantastic. I love hearing that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So, I don't know how – I don't know. I know if you go to the – if you go to MoreliaPythonRadio.com and you go to what I have dubbed the NPR library – and if you go there, you can click on to his current book, and that'll take you out to, I believe it takes you to a link to where you can get it, or it takes you to his website, and he can send you to a link. I want to say it's Zoo Books, but if you don't have a copy of this and you're into Morelia, I would even say if you're into scrub pythons and you're not even really into bowlands pythons, because scrub pythons are not the easiest to breed either.
No.
Pick up a copy of this. It's where the scrubs are from. There's a ton of information in there about the New Guinea and just the temperatures and the climates and the rainfall, the people. It's a really fascinating book. And I'm looking forward to the next one because I really think that, scrubs and bowlands are the sister species. I think that's
we can add a third book to the library now because we'll have the complete part carbon python in both of Ari's books.
Yeah.
So, woo.
Yeah. There's a lot of books out there. I think the only one that I have to add left is the Pythons of the World, which is it's like a rarity these days. I'm so glad I have a copy of that. But
I've been looking at like at the Hamburg show and a few other shows. There's usually some people who bring reptile books. And, you know, I would ask that if you are going to a reptile show, don't just blow through those booths because there's no snakes at them, because that is where some of the books are going to be. I mean, and I did see the complete carpet python on Saturday, and I was actually looking for the complete antaresia because I forgot it didn't come out. But figuring being a co-host of, you know, Morelli Python Radio, I should know these things, but whatever. Whatever. And Ari's book was among some of the books that are over there. So it's one of those things. If you go over, check it out. There could be some books. I think that you should have an extensive library just on basic reptile knowledge anyway. I've kept every single Reptiles magazine I've ever gotten in the mail, some of which have to do with carpet python, some of which have to do with anything else under the sun. Some of which, like the recent carpet python issue, I disagree with completely, but I still have it. So,
I heard about that one,
It was, I don't want to talk bad about somebody
I got you.
You did. Who probably put a lot of work into writing an article on carpet pythons when it's like, you know, who is this guy? And again, being a co-host of Morelli Python Radio, I should know who the hell is being the author. And when I don't, it sends up a wonderful little red flag. But anyway, it's one of those things. But you still have it because you never know one of those things is going to come in handy, especially with me because I am a registered rescue for reptiles in the city of Philadelphia. And every once in a while I get phone calls about, like, you know, what would you like to take this alligator? And if I had no idea how to set up an alligator, it'd be nice to grab a magazine and be like, all right, well, the good enough temps. So.
Right.
Yep.
Yep.
I'm done.
I agree.
Now. Yeah, I'm good now. I'm happy. Okay. I'll get off to put the soapbox away. So.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I just I'm just gonna run down a couple things real quick. I'm not gonna go into extensive things, but definitely check out the forums, Morelia Python forums at www.moreliapythons.com. Go check out moreliapythonradio.com. And next week we have Marcial Mendez talking chondros. Looking forward to that. A little chondro talk, taking it away from the carpet talk. And then the following week is right before our Christmas break. Who knows, we'll be stopping by. And then we'll be gone for 2 weeks. And who knows who's going to be at
the coast. Year.
Yeah.
So, what do you mean? What'd you say, back to host? You're firing me, aren't you?
Oh, no. No. Our good banter back and forth, Owen, makes for good radio.
I can't get rid of you. Who else? That's right. You can't get, like, you can't bring Luke on and be like, you know, yeah, I hate the light side. He's like, me too. Like, oh, well, all right.
Yeah. You got to have that back and forth, so. It's good. I mean, it's good to get all aspects of the world of Morelia. I'm looking forward to maybe getting Chris on here to talk about some scrubs and some whitelets.
Yeah.
That would be pretty cool.
He's all about that. We just got to hammer it down when he's going to do that. You just let me know when the break is in the schedule for what we've already booked, and I'll have him jump on.
Okay.
Hopefully by then we'll have something good to report on the forefront of our scrub and whitelet season.
Yes.
Baby barnacks for all. Pay for them. But, you know, it's one of those things.
Very good. Yeah, that's all I got.
Sweet.
What do you got, Owen?
For us, we have check out rogue-reptiles.com. I have just completed updating the site, there is bios for myself, Chris. There's bios for every single animal we currently have in the collection that is breeding. There's also a few snakes up for sale. I'm still updating that. For snakes for sale, you can go on kingsnake.com, search rogue-reptile. It's got everything up there. I will be adding more as they start passing their, I guess you can call them tests to go up for sale. We don't have any shows till January, so nothing to really report there. I would ask for one simple thing. I am looking for a male water python. If anybody out there has an adult male Australian water python, please get in contact with us through Rogue Reptiles or Rogue's Facebook page. I need one, or I got two girls that are not going to be able to do anything this year. And
oh, no.
Yeah, well, the boy that we currently have is he got a little sick, and we've got him back up, but I don't think he's going to go this year. So rather than waste the water python season, we are trying to find another boy. But with water pythons, it's you have 10 million of them all over Kingsnake, then nothing for like 8 months.
Yep.
And then they'll be all over it, and then they'll be gone again. So I'm trying desperately to find this guy. Because I got these two girls that are primed and ready and got no boy. So we will try to see what we can do. Otherwise, we're going to miss out on the only liasis we had this year. But I refuse to give up. So.
All right.
That's enough. I'm stopping. All right. other than that, I got nothing else. So if you got nothing else, I guess we'll just say good night, and thank you, everybody, for coming in and listening, and we'll catch you all next week for some more Morelia Python Radio.